let's begin. So today in the in our series on introductions, we're going to take up the introduction to the Sefer Achinuch. Now this might come as a surprise to some people because the Sefer Achinuch is the present that every bar mitzvah kid gets at his bar mitzvah, and as you'll see, ostensibly that's because the Sefer Achinuch actually was written from a father to his son, and it sometimes comes across as a very simplistic sefer, which is very unfortunate. It happens to be a very sophisticated sefer, and as you'll see as we go through the Hakdama, you'll get a sense of the author's a very unique perspective on Judaism. It's certainly a what in 21st century sense very unconventional, and we'll see what you think about it. So, to begin, the famous question that comes up by the Sefer Chinuch is, "Who was he?" Answer actually is, we don't really know who the author was. The book appears in about the 13th century Spain, but there's never an author listed in the actual text itself. There's been various discussions among academics as to who the author is. Usually, the name is Rav Aharon Halevi, and then there's a whole machlokas, which Rav Aharon Halevi. So, don't really know who the author was, which makes life a lot easier insofar as going through his history, since we don't have to list all the Sfarim he wrote, etc., because we just don't know who he was. But he did write a pretty extensive introduction to his work, so that gives us what he called something to focus on. And that's also pretty amazing for those who've actually read the Sefer HaChinuch before, been through it. It's a pretty amazing gift to give to your son to write a Sefer of such incredible excellence and wisdom. Okay, so he begins the introduction as follows. Basically, he comes right out, and this is a big theme in his introduction, and he comes back to it several times in the Sefer HaChinuch, which is the idea of the supremacy of human testimony. Now, this plays a big role, especially today, where the argument for Sinai is a very popular argument, and it's based on the idea of truth being ascertained through human testimony. Now, today, I wouldn't say that's that different today. For instance, just to put it in today's terms, there's a big debate, or I should say there's an issue that's emerged where if many people on, let's say, social media believe something to be true, does that make it true? So the Chinuch would say yes. He was a big believer in the idea that human testimony goes a long way towards something being true. So even to the point where if I trust something based on my senses, but a large group of people, and you'll see in a second how this works, large group of people challenge that. So sometimes you may want to listen to that large group of people. So the Chinuch maintained that the more witnesses there are to any specific event, so to speak, the greater the truth quotient. And that's a big, what do you call, critical part of his whole entire approach. And how important is this idea of the supremacy of human testimony? So we know in halacha, it's interesting that he mentions not even limit to halacha, but in other religions, but we know in halacha that we would kill someone based on the testimony of two witnesses. So we see that witnessing something, multiple witnesses, plays a big role in establishing truth. And the more witnesses attest to the historicity of an event, the greater, so to speak, the truth is of said event. So that's the first point he makes is understand that human testimony is of the highest level of importance. So that being the case, he says even within a family, okay, when it comes to let's say in the Ginsburg family, that there's certain stories that are told. So we accept that to be true as well. So I'll give you an example. Let's say my great-great-grandfather told his son, which would be my great-grandfather, that he had fought in World War I. Okay, and then my grandfather told me that he heard from his father, who had heard from his father, that he had fought in World War I. So if I heard it from my grandfather, right, it's very likely that I'll believe it as being true. So there is something the Chinuch points to. It's an interesting idea. There's something about the nature of familial testimony that lends itself to us accepting it as being true. Now, again, you could always argue that that doesn't necessarily mean it is true, right? But you could also, the counter to this would be the idea that it's very difficult to introduce a cultural history into a familial chain. Meaning, it would be very odd if, let's say, we gathered together four generations of Ginsburgs, and then someone came along and said, "By the way, did you know that, let's say, the oldest Ginsburg in the generation, his grandfather was really like, let's make up something outlandish, was actually had wings and flew around, and blew fire out of his mouth. So we would think that's unlikely, not just because it's miraculous, right? But more because we would have known about it. The nature of familial testimony is that it's common knowledge within the family. And it's not impossible, but it's very rare to introduce a false narrative or a foreign narrative into a familial history. So that's the other idea the Chinuch wants to emphasize, is that there's the quantitative idea of major amounts of witnesses testifying to the truth of the event. There's also the idea of familial testimony, which is where in one family, which you can even expand to the idea of culture, so it's very difficult to introduce a false history into that culture. It's very unlikely that they're going to end up believing it. Again, it's not a guarantee. I can't emphasize it enough. When it comes to history, this is sometimes people have a little bit of a difficult time with this, okay? History is not science. History, in other words, our reliance on history, we leave the primary method of ascertaining information, which is our own senses, and we rely on testimony of others. Once we allow others to get into the picture, so there's no way to guarantee that it's true. A perfect example is the fact you have people who are Holocaust deniers. And part of their argument is that they'll say, well, it could be that the witnesses were coerced. It could be that the photographs and the movies are doctored. That is actually theoretically possible. It's just highly unlikely. And if for history to work, history requires trust. That's what makes it very different than something like, well, for now, something like science or mathematics, where trust, the idea of trust isn't as critical as a point. By history, there's a tremendous amount of trust that we say we're going to believe the testimony of people when it comes to a certain event. So as he says, the more you expand the numbers, the more the idea of familial acceptance becomes more believable. And like I said, it does not mean it's certainty. And I can't stress that enough. It's really important to always understand that when it comes to history, history makes a plausible claim, but history does not have the same level of certainty as, let's say, something in logic or mathematics. It just seems like a very likely, possibility. But as we all know, I don't want to wade into today's political climate, but as a perfect example, there's ideas of creating false narratives in the news, depending on which side of the spectrum that you're on, determining who's saying what, which is false. And you see that you can create parallel narratives. Another example, by the way, is again, not to wade into politics, but looking at as an objective observer, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, where you have two groups of people who have completely different narratives of the historical events that took place. So you see the nature of history doesn't subject itself to the same empirical rigidity that you'd find in something like science. Okay. So, of course, now the reason why he's bringing down the importance of human testimony is because it all comes down to the giving of the Torah. So the Chinuch, whereas the idea of the argument for Sinai, or some people call it the proof for Sinai, has become very popular today, much more popular, very, very popular today compared to, let's say, a couple hundred years ago. The truth is that the actual argument for Sinai is presented in the Kuzari, but not in a very detailed way. The Chinuch actually fleshes out the Kuzari's argument a little more in depth. Basically, what he explains is that the Torah was given to millions of witnesses. Again, that's a calculation of 600,000 males, assuming they were married. A lot of them were married, and they had multiple kids. At minimum is 2 million people. It could be anywhere up to that, up to 4 million people. The Chinuch takes that as being a historically valid claim. And what happened, as we all know the story, the information of what happened at the event was given down to their children. So now you have the two qualifications. You have the mass amount of people witnessing an event, and you have the familial passing down of the information. You have father to son and father to son, etc. You have that taking place at Sinai. The other thing the Chinuch adds, which makes the method of acquiring the information a little bit different, is that when the Jewish people were at Sinai, okay, they were all, this is a famous idea, they were all raised to the level of prophecy, meaning the Jewish people at Sinai were like Nevi'im, were like prophets. Now, why is it critical to be like a prophet? So the Chinuch explains, because whenever you receive something through prophecy, there's no issue whatsoever of there being a doubt insofar as the veracity of what you're receiving. So not only does the quantity of people play a role, but the fact that they were all, so to speak, prophets meant that the information they were receiving, the event, the witnessing of the event, okay, and the information they received at that event itself could never be subject to any type of question whatsoever. So that's the other point. The the chinuch is bringing down. And again, to put it in the mathematical equation, mass witnesses plus quality of message equals as close to certainty as possible. And that's what the chinuch is looking for. He's looking for the idea of the Torah being a valid document of divine origin requires it to these qualifications, requires mass witnesses, and requires a certain quality to the message. So that's his starting point insofar as validity of the Torah. So now he comes along and says, it's interesting, he says, the chinuch is very funny in his akdama. As you'll soon see, he sets up a series of questions. It's written in a very interesting style of question, answer, question, answer. So he says, one could posit the following argument. One could say, and he says as a quote, what need have you, O Jew, of your received tradition? Meaning, what's the necessity of, what he called, of having this Torah? What's the need for the Torah per se? Okay, of having it done in this manner, of ish bipi ish, of passing it down. Why is this so critical? Because the person could say, and this is, again, this is alluding to more of a philosophical approach. You see a certain tone here the chinuch is taking in, similar to, for instance, Hirsch, and the idea of, you know, be careful when it comes to philosophy. What could a person do? A person could turn to the natural world, and through looking around the natural world, you can come to perceive God. So the Torah itself can't be the only avenue to perceiving God. I can reach the conclusion that God exists simply through analyzing the world around me. Now, in his conception, he uses famous Aristotelian ideas like the four elements and, for instance, the power that causes these spheres to rotate. For those who are familiar with the Rambam and others, know that was the basic outlook for centuries. According to the chinuch, this approach of using philosophy to come to the conclusion of God, that can only take you so far. That's a limited approach. You need the Torah, all right, to go ahead and really get to the core idea of who God is. So as he's going, now he moves back again to, again, the importance of mass testimony. And I thought of an example. Ad populum in logic refers to a type of fallacy, which is appeal to the masses. But the appeal to the masses is something that the chinuch really takes seriously. So he says as follows, and I'll give you an example. Let's say you get a cup of a Starbucks Pike Place roast in front of you, something Baruch Hashem I still have the chance to have almost on a daily basis, although my supply is running low. So let's say hordes of people came running into my house. Okay, they said to me, Ginsburg, do not drink this cup of coffee. It's laced with poison, right? Or if you're a coffee connoisseur, poison is synonymous with being over-roasted as beans, but let's say it's laced with poison, okay? But let's say a barista came over, amazingly, at the same time to my house and said, don't worry about it, drink away, meaning the barista is the expert in the coffee, right? So now you have an interesting quandary. You have hordes of people, let's say 5,000 people tell you, do not drink that cup of coffee, it's definitely laced with poison. But note, these hordes of people are not experts at drinking coffee. They're just saying this coffee has poison in it. Against the, so to speak, expert in coffee coming along and telling you, no, what are you talking about? Drink the coffee. It's good. It's Starbucks. You're going to love it, right? So according to the chinuch, of course you would ignore the barista. You would trust the mass testimony of the non-experts, okay, over the singular testimony of the expert, right? So if you think about it, it's a very interesting idea if that's really the case. But the chinuch is presenting this method as saying that's how we ascertain information. No, according to him, no one would ever listen to the singular person, they'd always trust the hordes of people. So he says, since our minds ultimately lack the ability to always obtain the ultimate truth of things, right? As human beings, we try to really understand the truth of what things are, but we're limited. We're limited as a human species, we're always limited to get to the core of an issue. It's better to rely on testimony as a whole as being a source of truth than just on our own singular, experience. That's a very, very fascinating idea. That's not something I would say today is necessarily that intuitive, but the chinuch certainly maintains this to be a core concept. Oh, better to rely on testimony of the masses than any other way of ascertaining truth. So 5 million, you know the old saying, if 5 million people told you, try to sell you the Brooklyn Bridge, you should buy it. That's what the chinuch would say. It's better to rely on the masses when it comes to ascertaining what is true. Okay. That being the case, now he moves into, like I alluded to before, these series of questions, very, very interesting questions, which I think might to some people be very interesting. Others might actually be offensive, what his answers are. But it still behooves us to go through each one of these questions. So he starts off with a very interesting question. He says, why did God give the Torah to humanity? And I'm going to use that. I'm using that word humanity for a reason here, as we'll get to in a second. But that's his first question. Why did God give the Torah? Why did God give the Torah? Okay. So of course, certainly if anyone knows from the Rambam and many others, to ask why did God questions is really an absurd line of questioning, because we can't ask that. How can we ever ask why did God do something? Okay. What we can say is that, and this sometimes people make an error with this, you can understand the purpose of something God did. Okay. That's not a what we call teleological question. That's saying, for instance, there is something called gravity, and now I want to understand how gravity works. But to say, to ask why does gravity have to be the way it is, or why did God create gravity, how could you answer such a question? It's almost like an absurd type of reasoning. So the Chinuch says, you can't ask a question about why did God decide to give the Torah. But then he says, but maybe we can answer, we can ask such a question. He's like, it's very funny the way he writes it. He's like, so asking such a question is really dumb, but you know what? Let's give it a shot. Even though it's a dumb kind of question, we will kind of give it a shot. So he says as follows. He says, all the works of God are perfect. Okay, that's premise number one. And that's something that you'll find in many, many Jewish theologians, the idea that everything that God does by definition is perfect. And included in this idea of perfection must be the universe itself. I mean, the universe must be perfect. If God, everything God does is perfect, and he created the universe must be perfect. And we look at God's creations, now he divides them up into different categories. We have angels, okay, which really are pure intelligences, or we'll call them non-physical things, okay, that are just pure seichel. We have the heavenly spheres, okay, for those, again, into Aristotelian physics. The heavenly spheres refers to, let's say, for instance, the planets or the other Galgalim, right? And these things, that these are things that they believed were intelligences that had physicality, but the difference with their physicality is that they would never come to an end. So as far as they saw, something, for instance, like the sun or the planets, they were intelligences, okay? Tovim ba'oro shabar l'keno yitzarim bedas b'vina b'askel, koachu gvura nasolem, right? But they would never die. They wouldn't fit into the normal, I'd say, model of what physical things are. Then there's physical creatures like animals, okay? You could even argue plants too, but animals which have no intelligence, okay? And then, of course, there's us, okay? So what are humanity? Humans are different. We're the unique creatures on Earth, because as we all know, we combine together both the physical and intelligence. So in this perfect universe, and this is, got to follow the line of reasoning here, in the perfect universe, right, where everything God does is perfect, he created different kinds of creatures. So one example of the perfect creature is an angel. Another example of a perfect creature could be, let's say, the ant that's crawling on the floor right now, and then human beings as well. But there's a catch with human beings, okay? Because what is the objective? What is the objective of human beings? It's to acknowledge God. Okay, so let's just take that as axiomatic for now. That the primary objective of human beings is to acknowledge HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, now if that's the case, okay, the problem is that the way God created us, he created us in a way where, naturally speaking, we're drawn towards the world of the instinctual. Again, just to look at this in a very binary way. In a sense, we're part animal and part angel, okay? I don't like to be, I mean, it's the easiest way to put it, meaning we have this physical part of us and this intelligent part of us. So now the physical part of us is just naturally drawn towards the physical world. It wants to be involved in hedonistic activities. That's just who we are, okay? But if we went ahead and gave in to that animalistic drive, then the distinction between animal and human would disappear. That perfect, so to speak, differentiation between angel, let's say heavenly sphere, animal and human, right? The animal-human differentiation would just basically vanish if we lived our lives giving in to these desires that lead us towards the instinctual world. And that would create a defect in creation. Okay, so the perfect being, according to, without getting into free will, the perfection of humanity is our engaging and acknowledging a Kaddish Baruch Hu. That's what our objective is. And that's living in line with how God created us. Okay. If we go ahead and do not make use of the intelligence. Rather, we give in to our physical. So then we're exposing a defect in the creation. Now, of course, you could argue and say, well, why did God, if we're going to go down the why did God road, right? Why did God go ahead and create man in a way that allows him to go ahead and be drawn to this physical world? Meaning, is that part of a perfect creation? It's a good question. It's not so simple how he would, how he escaped that. But our job isn't to attack the chinuch completely yet. We'll say that for later on. What does he say the solution for this defect in creation is? It's very simple. It's the Torah. The Torah is there to go ahead and give humanity the ability to create that potential defect. But one second. If we say the Torah is the resolution of the defect in humanity, so the next question he raises is, well, then why would God only give it to the Jews? That's a very interesting question. I mean, we've all learned this question. We've all heard this question in grade school at some point. The question of, why did God give the Torah to the Jews? Now, I know the Medrash. I know the idea of God tested it out. God focus grouped the Torah with other nations. I get that. That's from the Gemara. But the Chinuch's not interested in that. He just wants to know, based, again, going in the order he's going in, you have this idea that the Torah is necessary for humanity, right? Humanity needs the Torah to guide it away from the instinctual. So if that's true, why would the Torah only be given to the Jewish people? Okay? And again, what do you call it? You could always play the don't why card, but don't ask why card, but the Chinuch still wants to give it a shot. So what is it? Okay, now this is definitely not a 21st century view, all right? In the physical world, okay, according to the Chinuch, the vast majority of the physical world is a complete waste. An analogy he gives is, he gives the analogy of like fields. He says like agricultural fields. When you look at the amount of land that's on earth, right, much of it is really a waste. Most of it, from an agricultural standpoint, only a very small percentage is used to grow food, okay? Or as he puts it, only a small amount of the entire world is considered the prime of the prime. Now, we have to stop for a second and ask ourselves, doesn't that contradict the very idea of everything God making seeming to be perfect? If the vast majority of the physical world is a waste, that almost implies that what God did was a purposeless or wasteful action, which is impossible. So I'm not sure, it's a very interesting thing that the Chinuch, and he says this in a very strong way, the Chinuch maintains that the vast majority of the physical world is a waste. It's a strong word to use. It's also a very damning indictment, as you soon see, on humanity as a whole. So he says the same differentiation that exists between the physical world, right, within the physical world of, let's say, most of it being a waste, but some part of it being prime, you have that same differentiation within humanity, okay? Now this gets very, very Aryan on the surface. But what does it mean? He says that God chose the Jewish people because they are the choice part of the human species. They're the best. The best of humanity are the Jewish people, okay? And now this raises all sorts of fascinating questions. Trust me, we could spend the next 2 hours, if we wanted to, all night, discussing the idea of, is there an intrinsic supremacy to the Jewish people? It's a very, very difficult idea to swallow because, first of all, certainly in Western society, and we're obviously victims of this ideology. The idea of a superior race raises all sorts of horrific visions of genocide. That's certainly not something that we'd want to really take to heart. But there's a more basic question, which is that the Torah says lo betzid kasecha. The Torah openly says that the Jewish people are not a superior race. There's nothing intrinsically superior. In fact, when God, for instance, in Mitzrayim, when God decides he's going to go ahead and save the Jewish people, it says he hearkens back to the bris that he made with Abraham, meaning that it's not that the Jews were like such great people, they deserved it, right? There's nothing intrinsically superior to the Jewish people, but the Chinuch disagrees. He says that God looked into humanity and saw the Jews as being the best part of the human species. So because they're the best part, only they could get the Torah. But what's going to happen to the rest of humanity now? Right. If you recall, when we did the Rambam Sakdama to the Parish Mishnayos, the Rambam said that most of humanity is there to serve the Talmud Chacham. They're there to make sure the Talmud Chacham doesn't have to work too much. The Chinuch has, a more generous answer. He says, even if you're not Jewish, don't worry. Okay, we have a system in place, the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach, that ensure that humanity will always remain separate from the animals. Okay, so as long as the seven Noahide laws are being followed, that's insurance that humanity will continue to differentiate themselves from the animals. Okay, That's not so bad. But then, of course, the question is, the easy question to ask is, then why give the Torah? Why wouldn't it be sufficient just to have Shiva Mitzvahs Bnei Noach? So it's interesting that again, in the Chinuch's viewpoint, you're going to have basically like two tiers of people. You're going to have the best, and you're going to have like the okay, right? And the okay can never be the best. They have the seven Noahide laws, but that's not nearly as good as having the Torah. So again, I would argue today that would be a very controversial view to present to people. Although there definitely are streams of Jews today who definitely believe in the intrinsic superiority of the Jewish people over everyone else, to the point where I know I've had plenty of arguments with people who said that the Jewish soul is really a different kind of soul. By a bunch of people already asked me, what about converts? It's a great question. That's a great question, what he would do with a convert. It's a very, very good question. But it's important to stress this. Don't think it's naive to think that this idea of intrinsic superiority does not exist in certain streams of Jewish theology. There are definitely people, important people, so to speak, who believe this to be the case. Yes. Okay. So then, I'm Skula. Yeah, of course. Right.
There is something to it.
Right, but on the other hand, you see Lovitzit Kasecha, right? And by the way, that temtihuli mamlechas konim goy kadosh, meaning God, you could argue that what God is saying is God's giving us a system that, if we adhere to the system, allows us to be differentiated. You know what I mean? In other words, that temtihuli mamlechas konim kadosh is talking about how what's going to make us goy kadosh, the idea of the Torah. But the Chinuch's reversing it. The Chinuch's saying that, like, God knew that the Jews are intrinsically superior, so therefore that's why they're the only people who could have the Torah. But you're 100% right. This tension, without question, this tension exists. There's no question that this is a tension that exists insofar as are the Jews to be looked upon as superior or not. 100%. It's just amazing how...
I mean, they were the arm that was chosen to... he doesn't say it, but any of the Noahide,
Yeah. So, but if you didn't think there was enough with his idea of delineation, so now he takes the next step, which is that, okay, within the Jewish people, okay, God said there is the best of the best of the best, which is Shevet Levi. Now, I am a Kohen, so I know that Shevet Levi is the best of the best. I mean, anyone here who's from Shevet Levi clearly knows that the Chinuch is right. That Kohanim, certainly the Kohanim, definitely, are the best of the best of the best. That's not even a question. But the point is that he doesn't explain why this had to be the case. He's just making an observation that God didn't stop with differentiating the Jewish people from the rest of humanity, but he also went ahead and took from within them, he took one group of people and said, these people are the best of the best, okay? But now, the Chinuch, it's a very simple move he's making, because the same thing takes place when it comes to the home of the Jewish people. It's like a beautiful convergence of both ideas. Not only did he differentiate a nation, but he also differentiated a land, that Eretz Yisrael, right, is the best of all the lands of the world, okay? And then within, which we all know, okay, that Israel is definitely the best place to live, right? And of course, within Eretz Yisrael, what's the best of the best? Yerushalayim, literally basically the base of Mikdash. So just like Shevet Levi is differentiated, just like the Jews are differentiated from humanity, and Shevet Levi is differentiated from the Jews, so too Eretz Yisrael is differentiated from the rest of the world, and the Beis HaMikdash is differentiated from the rest of Eretz Yisrael. So that analogy really, holds up. Now it gets a little cryptic, because he says, if the Jews really are such great people, if they're really to be differentiated, if they're the best of the best, why do they suffer so much, right? Why is, again, following his line of questioning, he goes question to question to question. Why did you suffer so much? Why is the Jewish life such a difficult life? And in fact, as we all know, as many know, people ask questions about converts, when someone wants to convert to Judaism, one of the things you tell them to, in a sense, dissuade them from converting is, well, the life of a Jew is a difficult life, right? It's a life of suffering. It's a life where if we follow the Torah, we're rewarded, but if we don't, we get punished. So the Chinuch has a little bit of a different answer. He starts going into a little bit about the idea of Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. He says there are two worlds. There's obviously this world, And then there's the world to come, okay? And he implies, right, that this is the implication, that, and this is the Ramban is much more overt about this idea, but he says that basically the knowledge of what the enjoyment of the world to come will be like makes any suffering in this world worth it. The Ramban has an idea of I'd say like a checks and balance system of if I suffer in this world, it'll be made up in the world to come. So the Chinuch is alluding to a similar concept that basically if I go ahead and if I suffer here, part of the idea is to recognize that, yeah, it's true, I'm suffering, but I should know that I'll be made up for it in the enjoyment that I'll get in Olam Haba, okay? Fine. But if that's true, so then the Chinuch now says, then why have two separate realms of pleasure? Meaning, why would you have pleasure in Olam Hazeh? And why also have pleasure in Olam Haba? Because why is it set up that way? Because we know that Olam Hazeh has certain pleasures, right? People feel good when they're eating, for example. So why would you, the Chinuch's next question is, why have two separate realms of pleasure? Why have such a thing? Okay? So, he says like this. He says, it's impossible, okay, it's impossible for any person to live in this world without sinning. Now, I know today, again, unfortunately, this has become a little too common as a philosophical idea in the sense that there are people today who look at Jewish religious leaders as saints, as human beings that they could never imagine in a million years would ever commit a sin. That is not a Jewish idea. If anyone just spends 5 minutes reading any random page in Navi, you will see that the nature of humanity and Jews is to sin. Jews sin. That's what it is. The Gemara says so, you know, Ein Tzadik B'chol Aretz. Everyone sins, okay? So why is that important? So we know a person needs to be punished for a sin they commit, right? So in this world, what's going to happen is that if I commit a sin, I will get punished for that sin, right? So if that's the case, then I'll miss out on both the physical and spiritual realms of pleasure because being punished for the sin would mean that now I go ahead and I get punished, and punishment is the removal of the pleasure. Punishment is the opposite of pleasure, okay? So by keeping one realm separate, okay, meaning the physical world, you can gain pleasure but also be punished, so you have that balance exist inside the physical world. In Olam Haba, that doesn't exist at all. In Olam Haba, there's only one thing, where there's no reduction of pleasure possible. There's simply 24/7 engaged with God pleasure. So the reason why he created two realms of pleasure is, it's interesting the way his answer, he's not giving a positive reason for it. Rather, he's saying that in the physical world, there is pleasure, but there's also pain. That pain won't exist in Olam Haba. So then again, going back to his point, a person will appreciate Olam Haba so much more because of the pleasure he'll get there. But of course, there will be a period of time where both the realm of pleasure of the physical world and the pleasure that exists of Olam Haba will now join together. And that is Yemos HaMashiach. In Yemos HaMashiach, he says there really won't be a Yetzihara, okay? And if there's no Yetzihara in this world, there'll be no idea of being judged for sin. The concept of being judged for sin won't exist anymore. But he's about to, if he just stopped there, he would really be taking up the idea given by many, by many Jewish theologians, the idea that in the times of Mashiach, so there's no Bechir anymore, there's no free will, that basically we're like automatons. We're like, what are we doing? We're doing mitzvahs all day. There's never every part of us that would ever think otherwise. But he doesn't quite adhere, he doesn't quite commit to that. He backs up a little bit and says, no, people can still sin a little bit. There'll be like some small sins. And any small sin that you have will be taken care of by the Seir Lazazah. As we all know, there are two Seirim that are sacrificed on Yom Kippur. One of them is the one that's thrown off the cliff. That one carries the sins of the Jewish people. So people will still be sinning a little bit. Now, to his credit, he doesn't really bring this up, but I think what he's alluding to is a really critical part of the nature of the halachic system itself. For people who've been to some of my shirim know that I've said before that the halachic system is really meant to function in a utopian Jewish society, especially when it comes to Sanhedrin. If you ever go to Masechah Sanhedrin, just take up any area, for instance, like kidnapping or or murder, the ability to prosecute those crimes or to be held liable can never exist the way society is today because we're just too violent and it's too common, etc. You need a society where the idea of Egla Rufa, that's always the example I like to use, You have to live in a society where the idea of Egla Rufa is a shock, meaning the idea of coming across a dead body is something that would just blow people away. Oh my God, there was a murder. We just don't live in that kind of society. For us, unfortunately, murder is not so much in Israel, but I'd say so in America, murder is a common thing. So the point he's trying to make here is that in the times of Mashiach, the halachic system will really operate the best of its capabilities. Another example, by the way, it's an easy one. This is low hanging fruit. Is Lashon Hara. No, I think it does reflect an ideal society because let's take Lashon Hara, right? I don't think Tzaraas could never work today, right? Because people speak Lashon Hara like crazy, right? I mean, you'd have a society where 95%, I'm probably saying Lashon Hara about Jews right now, but 95% of B'nai Israel would be in some sort of bidud as a result of Tzaraas. So the Chinuch is saying that Yemos Mashiach, it'll be the halachic system will be operating basically the way it's supposed to operate in a semi-utopian, I'd say, system. What do you call it? Yes. Okay. Now he moves on to the next question. Okay. So if Olam Haba is the most important idea and that's the reward for following the mitzvos, okay, then how come God does not mention Olam Haba in the Torah? This is a famous question, not just asked by him, asked by the Rambam, asked by the Ramban. Many, many, many Jewish scholars ask the question, in a broader sense, if fundamental tenet of Judaism, X, is important, why is it not in the Torah? It's a good question. Why isn't Olam Haba in the Torah? All right. So what does he say as an answer? So he says like this. He says, it's very interesting, his answer. He gives a very, very different kind of answer. He says, Olam Haba is actually something that's very intuitive. And if you ask the man on the street and you say to them, what happens after you die? They would say that they continue to exist, that there's some sort of heaven or something along those lines. Okay? Now, the Chinuch is a little more sophisticated. He wants to say that, and this is why he says it. I didn't say this. He says this. Everyone knows that this is the ultimate outcome for a human being. Now, of course, and this is his quote, for the origin of the intelligent soul is from the source of intelligence, and the closer it gets to its natural habitat from which it originated, the greater is its delight. Again, referring to the fact that I have a non-physical part of myself, that non-physical part, which is essentially intelligence, okay, the closer it gets to its natural habitat, which means being purely non-physical, and in the world of intelligence, the greater it's going to be its delight. But, so if this is so clear, why would, there's, if it's such a clear idea, if everybody knows that you're going to get a chelik olam haba, if everybody knows that the natural state for humanity after you die is some type of world to come, so why would the Torah mention it? The Torah has no need to mention something that's so obvious. This is a very different answer. You're not going to find anyone else who gives an answer like this. That it's usually the opposite kind of answer, which is to try to justify, for instance, that B'nai Yisrael weren't ready to hear it. Or another example is, if the Torah mentions Olam Haba, then you're going to do the mitzvos for that reason. The point is that people come up with excuses of why it's not mentioned, but no one ever says it's really intuitive. But the Chinuch says no. The Chinuch says everybody knows. Everybody knows that the world to come is an obvious outcome of your life. So if that's true, why would the Torah have to mention something that's so obvious as that? Now, of course, you could also argue that the Torah mentions other things that you could argue are obvious, but we'll push that to the side. Now, today, the idea of having an intelligent soul is not universally accepted. If anything, actually, more and more people are becoming materialist, which is really driven by the scientific method, which is the idea that humanity is really, as I put it in my terms, a sack of meat, or basically you are your body. You're just a physical existence. So I'm not sure if the Chinuch interviewed people today, I'm pretty sure they would not say that obviously when I die, I'd go to the world to come. Okay. Now the Chinuch shifts over to... Okay. Now the Chinuch shifts over to some fundamental precepts of belief itself. It's interesting that he does this. But now that he's done with his questions, he gets into what he considers to be the most important things that Jews need to believe in to really be considered a Jew. Now, it's not quite as extensive as the Rambam, which he was definitely aware of. The Chinuch had read the Rambam. It's more of like an Albo type of thing, which would make sense because in that part of the world, that's already a Crescas Albo period of time, and they were condensing the Yugimli Karim. But nonetheless, what are the fundamental precepts of belief? So one of them is that God's a necessary existence, okay, which is a very common Aristotelian concept. creation ex nihilo, which means that God created the universe out of nothing. God's oneness, okay, the Yichud Hashem. And theism, that God is invested or has a relationship to the universe itself. It's very interesting, by the way, for those who've ever read the Aruch HaShulchan, and in the first siman on Aruch Chaim in the Aruch HaShulchan, he actually lists, prior to actually getting into halakha, he lists the chinuch's fundamental precepts of belief. He doesn't list the Rambam's. He doesn't list the Rambam. He lists the chinuch. He lists these that I just mentioned to you, these fundamental precepts, as necessary for every Jew to believe in. So basically, it comes down to, they all have to do with God. But what are they focused on? They're focused on necessary existence. They're focused on the idea that God is the creator of the universe. The universe is not eternal. And the idea of theism, what do you call it? The idea that God is, it's not a deistic model where God created the universe and has nothing to do with it. Rather, it's theistic, that God is somehow engaged with the universe itself. Okay? But not only that, the next fundamental belief after God is the accuracy of the Mesorah. Fascinating. He jumps right to this. He says it is critical that a Jew believe in the accuracy of our tradition. So he mentions this as a side point, but it's a very funny point. He says, why did it take 40 days for God to teach Moshe the entire Torah? Now, of course, there's a way to ask the question. There's two ways to ask this question. You could ask the question of, what do you mean? It should have taken him an infinite number of days. No. What he's saying is that since the Torah is being taught from the divine, what could God have done? God could have put the Torah into Moshe's head. So why did God stretch it out for 40 days when he could have just, in a sense, snapped his divine fingers and placed the information in Moshe's head? So the answer is to teach us a lesson. This is a very, very unique shot. The lesson is that you should be very patient when it comes to learning Torah. That Torah takes time to learn. And how do you see that to be the case? Because God didn't have to have Moshe take 40 days to learn the Torah, but he chose to do that to demonstrate the idea that when someone learns Torah, they should really, take their time. Okay. He then goes through a brief history of the oral law, Mishnayos, Talmud, Sifra, Tosefta. This is a common theme. If you read Rishonim, Rishonim always like to review the history of the oral law. All right. So as we know, Talmud, Tosefta, etc. Now he says all of them in some way reflect the true meaning of Torah itself. Okay. And he says, if you deny the oral law, okay, then you're just basically excluded from the Jewish people. So not only does the Jew have to have fundamental ideas about belief in God, but any denial of Torah Shebaal Peh, right, means by definition you're excluded from being the Jewish people, okay? Now, as we know, okay, the Torah itself, the Torah Shebichtav, is filled with all sorts of contradictions, all right? So why is that important? So what's important about that? What do you need Torah Shebaal Peh for? You need it to help solve these contradictions. So he gives a few examples, okay? And these aren't even contradictions. These are more that if you take the pshat literally, it's going to raise certain problems. So for instance, he quotes the pasuk that Bnei Yisrael were in Mitzrayim. As we all know, the Torah says for 430 years. But we know the years do not line up. That's not true. So how do we know that 430 is not to be taking, well, when I say literally, that you have to kind of finagle the numbers a bit and maybe start it off with when God spoke to Avram, Torah Shebaal Peh. You would never know that from Torah Shebichtav. Or, for instance, in Sefer Dvarim, it says 70 people went down to Mitzrayim, but we know when you actually count, it was only 69. Torah Shebaal Peh tells you the Yocheved was included in the count. So these are examples, not the strongest examples in the world, but examples that demonstrate why Torah Shebaal Peh is so important. Without Torah Shebaal Peh, you would take Torah Shebichtav literally. Okay. Not only do we know from our Mesorah, not only do we need Torah Shebaal Peh to explain to us, for instance, how stories in, or our history, right, worked out properly, we also know from our Mesorah that there are 613 mitzvos, okay? And we also know that within the mitzvos, there are different people who are obligated in different mitzvos themselves, and there are different types of mitzvos, okay? Now, this is already his transition into his Sefer, right? This is the first, I'm cheating ahead because I know what's in the Sefer Chinuch, but this is his first move into why he's writing the Sefer, because he's going to focus on the fact that again, you can't deny the accuracy of our Mesorah, and our Mesorah tells us that there are 613 mitzvos. And we know there's different kinds of mitzvos. There's different gavras for this kind of mitzvah, kohanim, there's a mitzvos eshman grama, all different categories of mitzvos, okay? As well, one of those mitzvos is learning Torah. And we know that Chazal places a serious, supreme level of importance on learning Torah itself. Now, it's interesting. How is the chiv of learning Torah fulfilled? Well, we know on a weekly level, it's fulfilled through the tzibur, through Kriyas HaTorah. In other words, Kriyas HaTorah is a type of limud. That's why you have a meturgaman. The idea of someone translating the Torah as it's read on Shabbos is because it has to be an act of limud. It has to be an act of learning. It's not an act, it's not a kore, it's a milamid. So the person who's laning is really, in a sense, teaching everybody what's written in the Torah. That's how you fulfill learning Torah. He mentions as an aside, just to show you, even in the 1300s, it still wasn't all completely universal. He makes an observation that most Jews have accepted the practice to complete it in 1 year. And that seems to imply that, the Rambam alludes to this as well, it seems to imply that around this period of time, you have the shift to more and more communities taking upon themselves completing the cycle of Kriyas HaTorah in 1 year. And like I always mention, Simchas Torah is a beautiful holiday, right? But it is a fabricated yontiv. It is mentioned in the Gemara briefly, but it really is not an intrinsic yontiv. Shmini Atzeres is the holiday we're supposed to celebrate, not Simchas Torah. Simchas Torah is very nice, but it's only based on the minhag we took upon ourselves to finish a cycle of the Torah every year. Now, what does the individual do to fulfill their chiyuv of learning Torah? Okay, you could argue the Gisabo Yom of Alayla, you could argue saying Kriya Shema twice a day, which many say that many argue that is how one fulfills individual chiyuv. No, the chiyuv mentions Shnai Mikra. Shnai Mikra, which is actually a rabbinical mitzvah. It's another one that unfortunately is not as popular as it should be. While I certainly have a tremendous amount of kavod for people who do Daf Yomi, but the fact is that Shnai Mikra is an actual mitzvah, and it plays a very important role. It's an amazing thing. One of the greatest frustrations I sometimes have in my field of education is that I can hear a guy quote a Gemara, but he doesn't know what Parsha Pasuk is from, which is insane. You have to know Torah Shebichtav first, and that's fulfilled through Shnai Mikra. So Shnai Mikra involves, unless you want to do it the Vilna Gaon's way, you do an Aliyah every day, okay? But that is a real mitzvah. Daf Yomi, every Yomi is very nice to do. But the truth is, that's all, what do you call it, Baruch Hashem. Yomi is very nice, but without Shnai Mikra is the starting point. First, make sure you have Shnai Mikra down, and then you can worry about other Yomis. But Shnai Mikra is a real halacha. It's just astonishing when I go recruit, when the guys come to the yeshiva, and I mentioned there's a mitzvah, Shnai Mikra, some people never heard of such a thing before. I find that to be very, very odd. But that is the way an individual can fulfill what it called their own personal chiyuv of learning, okay? Which makes a lot of sense. Now, finally, right, we're two slides from the end here. He finally explains why he wrote the book. Let's just review. We can't question the accuracy of the Mesorah. The Mesorah tells us the 613 mitzvos. Right? Those mitzvos have different, there's different types of mitzvos, different people obligated in them. We also know that there is a communal obligation to learn Torah and an individual obligation that's fulfilled through Shnai Mikra. So what's happening? What's happening is that, let's say, we're all studying the Torah on a weekly basis. Torah Shebichtav. So why did he write the book then? Well, he wrote the book for the following, okay? He says that mitzvos are scattered throughout the Torah, which we know. If you look, for instance, in Parshas Bo, so there's a couple of mitzvahs on Parshas Bo, scattered between the stories. If you look to, let's say, Parshas Bo Losecha, you'll find a few mitzvahs scattered between the stories. Sometimes you have parshas that only have mitzvahs, like Kiseitse. Sometimes you have things in there which you're not sure if they're mitzvahs or not. So mitzvahs are all over the place in Torah. So what does the Chinuch want to do? So he says the problem is that when a person goes through his Shnai Mikra, okay, when he goes through Shnai Mikra, he may not be aware. He may not be aware reading through the Torah itself, okay? May not be aware. Excuse my misspelling. A person may not be aware how many mitzvahs are in that actual Torah portion, okay? You open up, let's say, Parshas Bo. How many mitzvahs are in Parshas Bo? How many mitzvahs are in Parshas Noach? How many mitzvahs are in Parshas Kiseitse? How many mitzvahs are in Parshas Re? You won't know. You won't know in learning through the Parsha how many mitzvahs there are. And then, if I don't know all the mitzvahs that are in the Parsha, this is a big jump, by the way. If I don't know, you know what that could lead to? That could lead me to not be aware of all the mitzvahs and then not follow all the mitzvahs. So my ignorance of the content of mitzvahs in whatever Parsha I'm learning, when I'm doing my Shnai Mikra, my ignorance in not knowing all the mitzvahs that are there could lead to my lack of adherence to mitzvahs. So how do you solve the problem? Okay, so what you do is you write each mitzvah in the order they were given in the Torah. And that's what the Sefer HaChinuch ends up becoming. Basically, the Sefer HaChinuch goes by each parsha in the Torah based on the year cycle, okay? And it'll say, let's say Parshas whatever, Parshas Bo, has the following number of mitzvahs in it. So he goes in the order the mitzvahs were given in the Torah. He follows that parsha by parsha. Now, of course, not every parsha has a mitzvah in it, which he makes clear. But the point is that the mitzvahs follow that order. And what will this do? This will attract the heart of my young son and the youngest who are his friends. It's interesting. He thinks that by giving the Sefer to his son, who, by the way, is learning Shnai Mikra, that's the premise he has, right? That his son will take the book and be like, wow, look, I have this incredible book that really puts the mitzvos in the right order based on each parsha. So after I finish my Shnai Mikra of Brachos, I'll turn to the Sefer HaChinuch now and check to see how many mitzvos were in there. And guess what? All his friends will be like, wow, this is such a great Sefer. I can't wait to, what it called, to read it. So the key thing with the Chinuch is, it's interesting, the Chinuch was never meant to be studied as a separate Sefer. It was meant to be read after you complete the study of the weekly Torah portion. So if I go ahead and do my Shnai Mikra, and let's say I finish on Shabbos, after I'm done, I go pick up my Sefer Chinuch to basically investigate more of what I read in the Parsha insofar as the mitzvahs are concerned. Which leads us to the end, which is a brief review of what the structure of the Sefer is. And it's a really, really pleasant structure. What he first does is he lists the mitzvah, okay? And he lists the mitzvah, he lists the Torah source for the mitzvah, meaning what pasuk brings down the mitzvah and what the mitzvah is. And then he gives the rationale reason for the mitzvah. I can tell you that the Chinuch does an incredible job organizing Tamei mitzvos. And there's some Tamei mitzvos in there that I think are some of the most beautiful reasons possible given for mitzvos. Again, it's not about whether really being right or wrong, which he himself acknowledges at one point. I think it's by the issue of salt and honey by the Mizbeach, if I remember correctly. Over there, he gets into how even with all his rationales for mitzvahs, don't think that means that he really knows the reason why. But the point is, provides a tam for the mitzvah, and then he goes through an explanation of some of the halachas. So basically, like, for instance, who the mitzvah applies to or what kind of mitzvah it is. So if it's going to be, let's say it's mitzvah X. So say mitzvah X, this is the pasuk source for the mitzvah. This is the reason why God gave us the mitzvah, like what the objective of the mitzvah is. And then who does the mitzvah apply to? When does it apply? And what situations, etc. So that's the structure of the Sefer HaChinuch. And of course, he ends off with a few remarks about his own humility. That's like the last few paragraphs in the introduction, saying like, you know, he's, you know, not such a great person. But it really, the reason why I think the Sefer HaChinuch became such a popular Sefer is because it's ease of access. It's very accessible Sefer. But that doesn't mean that what he wrote is very, simple. It's not. A lot of the Chinuch's reasons for mitzvahs are very, very deep. And it's definitely a Sefer worth going through. And it's an interesting thing to try to do it the way he said, which is to go ahead and do your Shnai Mikra, do your learning of the weekly Parsha. And then after you're done, go seek out the Chinuch to really get a sense of the mitzvahs that are in there. Just to let you know as an aside, what I thought was a very, great idea in the Torah Chaim, which is the Mosad Rav Kook, Mikraos Gedolos, right? So in the back of each one of the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, they have divided up, you'll actually find the Sefer HaChinuch. It was a very good idea. When I first saw it, I just happened to have looked in the back and saw the Chinuch was in there. It's very good that they have the Chinuch in there because it's good. After you study the Parsha, don't forget about learning the Chinuch as well. The Chinuch is really part of the limud of the Parsha. Normally, when we look at Parshanim, we look at commentaries, we're looking for commentaries insofar as let's say the stories, you know, or even when it comes to mitzvos, the Chinuch is very good. It's very good that to look at him to kind of get a sense of a good overview of what mitzvos are included in the Parsha and the time of mitzvos for those mitzvos, as well as a little sense of the applicability of the mitzvah today and who's obligated it, etc. So that ends off the Hakdama to the Sefer Chinuch. I highly recommend the Sefer. I think it's a really, really good Sefer to learn. And we'll end off here.